everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities podcast brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's November 2022, and you are listening to episode 313, which is a conversation about something called spiritual friendship. Today's guest is Anne Kennedy. She has an MDiv and is the author of Nailed It, 365 Readings for Angry or Worn Out People, and blogs about current events and theological trends at Preventing Grace on Patheos.com. Anne has written an online exclusive feature article for the Christian Research Journal. Anne's article is called Spiritual Friendship, Temptation, or Belonging. And anyone can read this article for free on our website, equip.org. Now, we're making this article for free on our website without having access to our online exclusives because we want to give everyone a taste of the kinds of primary research articles that we do at the Christian Research Journal. So we hope you enjoy this free article, and why don't you share it on your social media feeds or email it to a friend, because anyone can read this and I think they will find it a very thoughtful and thought-provoking article. Anne, it's good to have you on again.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, a few episodes ago, we discussed a feature article that Anne had written for our fall issue, and her topic was about platonic marriage, which is marrying your best friend without a sexual union. And this kind of platonic marriage and relationship is kind of in vogue in non-Christian and non-religious circles. And so in this episode, I want to ask you about a kind of platonic marriage adjacent relationship that is kind of growing in popularity, at least talking about it in the Christian church, and it goes by the moniker spiritual friendship. So what is spiritual friendship and what are its origins?
Well, spiritual friendship is a growing term that I'm coming across more and more in church places. And I think it's kind of a little bit of a fuzzy term because it brings in, it's two big, huge words. Friendship, obviously, being an essential part. What does it even mean? What is friendship? And then the word spiritual can be a really dicey one in this age. But for Christians, it's a close relationship. I think usually, at least in its modern iteration, it would be between two people of the same sex, possibly two people who are attracted to each other, perhaps. And they would want to have a committed, deep relationship. They might even take vows to be friends with each other, maybe live in a proximity to each other, and that they wouldn't be able to sort of let go of each other and not be friends anymore without problems, or, you know, the kind of thing that if you were married to somebody, you would suffer. You'd have to go through hoops in order for that relationship to be severed. So in a sort of a nutshell, it seems to be the idea of vowing friendship to somebody that you really are deeply emotionally, maybe even physically attracted to. It's quite an old term, though. For the modern movement of spiritual friendship, it comes from Aelred, who lived in the 1100s and wrote a book called On Spiritual Friendship. He was a monk, and he apparently, I'm not sure about the scholarship on this, but some people claim that he was in same-sex attracted, that he was in relationships with men before he joined the monastery. But I would like to see more about that. But eventually he entered the monastery, and then he wrote very movingly about friendship and the desire to have a deeper intimacy with some people rather than with other people. And he describes that in his book. The modern spiritual friendship movement has taken his thread and expanded it in the modern age to be more about same-sex attraction, but they would say chaste. Most people who would say they were involved with spiritual friendship, I think, would say that they don't think that two men should have sexual relations with each other or two women. But they do think that there's a deep emotional bond that could connect them, and that reflected some sort of divine moment or spark, and or perhaps even related itself to the gospel. But as we're going to go on and talk, the term is very early in the Christian church. It referred to sort of chaste, maybe platonic relationships that men and women would have with each other, where they might live together but not engage in sexual intercourse. But we can talk about that more.
So you mentioned that there's a modern movement that has taken up this term spiritual friendship. So who is talking about spiritual friendship in the Christian church today?
There used to be a website called Spiritual Friendship. I think it's not really going now, but the main people who are writing about this and thinking about it, there's at least three. There's Eve Tushnet, Nate Collins, and Wes Hill, and then other people in the Revoice movement are writing and talking and speaking about this right now. The books that I read were by Wes Hill and Nate Collins and a lot of articles. And they, so it crosses over between Roman Catholicism, evangelicalism a little bit. It's an ecumenical kind of movement. And they engage with scripture, church history, and modern culture. So it definitely has a very modern feel of sexuality, the gender spectrum, those kinds of identity questions of today are part of the modern movement.
Now, you just mentioned three writers who would identify themselves specifically as gay Christians. Is that really where most of the conversation about spiritual friendship is taking place? And you also mentioned that it's not just within evangelicalism, but it's in all Christian traditions, including Roman Catholicism.
Yes, it is. It's very much a question of sexual attraction, same-sex sexual attraction, and the kinds of desires, the orientation towards that you might have towards someone of the same sex. It's interesting because it comes right up, I like the word adjacent a lot. It comes right up alongside the way that people talk about each other in marriage, but they do try to draw a line between what a marriage would be and what a spiritual friendship would be, but they share a lot of commonalities. And yes, it is. It's in the same sex world. They do use the word gay Christian as an identifier often, and it crosses ecumenical lines for sure.
So what are some of the specific characteristics that would be used to define spiritual friendship in these particular communities?
Well, again, I like the word marriage adjacent now that I'm going to have a hard time getting off of that, but it has a lot to do with regular friendship. So you want an emotional connection with someone else. You want to be able to spend time with them, to understand who they are. It's a way of dealing with loneliness that you might have in your life. So it's a regular friend, but it goes beyond that because this person has that kindred spark when you get to be with someone who just really gets you. That sort of pulls you deeper in. And so, I mean, Wes Hill writes very movingly about friendship in general and the deep connections that you can have with someone when you really come to understand them and choose to live near them and find that your soul is satisfied in some kind of way that it isn't when you're with, you know, or other kinds of people. So it's a very moving idea. And it, of course, I would say probably they would agree that this, you could definitely have a relationship like this in marriage if you feel deeply connected to your spouse. The modern world says you should definitely be friends with your partner. You know, it means that you go past all the other loose intimacies and you really pledge yourself to someone. And that possessive desire and longing to be with someone else, it, between your spirit and theirs, is the main sort of characteristic of what this is.
You are just using the term for it as maybe being marriage adjacent. And I guess I'm wondering, isn't marriage a deep type of spiritual friendship? I'm talking about in the modern sense, of course. Marriage in the past, many centuries ago, was very different than our understanding or rather our expectation of what we think a biblical marriage should be. I mean, obviously, people in the West don't have arranged marriages, although I'm sure there are some Christian communities in different kinds of cultures that aren't the West that might have arranged marriages that, you know, are good marriages. But in the West, marriages are usually, you know, motivated by love, some kind of other deeper relationship with a person before you enter into a marriage partnership with them for Christians. And so it's not like originally, you know, maybe if we look back at in the Bible, you know, marriage primarily was for, you know, procreation. And that is, of course, what Christians are called to, the cultural mandate to be fruitful and multiply. But I think most Christians in a modern sense are hoping or thinking that or are counseled that marriage should have a deep spiritual friendship component.
Yeah. Marriage is a thing in every culture, right? It exists across every single culture, and it goes all the way back to the beginning of the Bible. And I think even cultures where you have an arranged situation, I grew up in a world where marriages were arranged, and a marriage for love, they would say, was so unusual that it had its own name. No one would just go out and fall in love and get married. And I think many cultures actually around the world look at Western culture and think, oh, well, that's so great. If it is a myth, it's a powerful myth that you would fall in love with someone at a soul level, you would be connected physically, and then your lives, you would become one kind of new person together. That is really what the scriptures talk about. And so, yes, I think it's something that everybody longs for. It's interesting in spiritual marriage, the modern movement, they want to find that soul level connection with someone that they're not married to, and would say that you could be married to one person, but then have this kind of deep oneness with someone of the same sex who's not your marriage partner, which I find really incredible, having grown up in a culture where people did not fall in love and get married. But I think if they would have been able to, they would have wanted to. So to try to make a division between those things when we haven't really had one in the West is an interesting thing that's happening.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Journal. Once again, I invite you to do all the things that will help us when you partner with us to continue to bring you this free content on the Postmodern Realities podcast. Now, for our newer listeners, did you know that our very first podcast was all the way back 6 years ago in February 2016, and we are coming up on our 7th year anniversary in just a few months, when it's February 2023. So help us to keep going. Of course, subscribe at equip.org. Leave us a tip at equip.org journal, Postmodern Realities podcast landing pages. We love if you give us a written review at Apple Podcasts. We invite you to do that. Of course, share this episode on your social media feeds or email it, or simply just tell a friend. But any way that you do it, especially if you've been putting off subscribing to the Christian Research Journal, please go ahead and do that and help us continue to bring you this free content. And of course, we want to give you guys a sample of the kinds of exclusive, in-depth web articles that we do. And this one is from Ann Kennedy, and it is very in-depth research that she's done on the subject of spiritual friendship. You don't want to miss it, and you would want to head on over to equip.org to read it for free. Now, back to the conversation with Ann. Well, one thing I want to ask you about is just this idea of, you know, friendship, and then, you know, what we were just discussing a moment ago, which is a deep spiritual friendship in a marriage. I want to quote you something from C.S. Lewis, his book, The Four Loves. He says this in it, quote, "To the ancients, friendship seemed the happiest and most fully human of all loves, the crown of life and the school of virtue. The modern world, in compassion, ignores it." So this quote seems to suggest that friendship is even more deeply human than agape love, and that we have lost that in modern culture. So in this quote, do you think C.S. Lewis means that friendship is a more fully human, deeper relationship than even a Christian marriage?
I've run across this quote a lot reading all the literature of today, and it is a very interesting quote. And I think Lewis puts his finger on something that's really essential. And it is that there are many different ways to love someone or to be with someone or be attracted to someone. And I would agree, our modern world, in a very isolating, sort of bifurcated, strange way, thinks that you can atomize certain kinds of relationships and put some above others, and that the ordinary, in the trenches, love between two friends who just show up for each other and spend time together and have some kind of communion together is not privileged. It's not something that we value unless you can put sort of a price tag on it. And so romantic love for Americans, very highly prized. And I think in the West, the idea of ordinary friendship has been joined to romantic love in a kind of a unique way that I think we should hang on to. But I think most people are deeply, of course, they're deeply lonely and longing for ordinary friendship, and they don't even know where to find it. And they wouldn't want to, agape is sort of in its own separate category. Although it's been a long time since I've read The Four Loves, but I would say that at least for Christians, you would find that all the different kinds of love, friendship, agape, eros, sort of feed into each other, maybe not eros all the time. One gives way to the other and builds the other, and that they shouldn't be sort of held apart from each other. But Lewis is putting his finger on something essential. He was a single male academic for most of his life, though, and I think he would absolutely privilege his, you know, deep male friendships, which were not sexual at all, very highly, in a way that a man who maybe was married young and was really, really friends with his wife in a way that I don't think he was married later. He fell in love. It was more tragic. I don't know if he would have written about it differently if he had been married at a different time. So it's interesting to me that people take this quote as their main thing, especially reaching back to the ancients, who generally did not think that women were capable of this deep friendship. That was definitely a second sort of secondary, more base kind of thing. Who even knew if women could even be friends with each other? You know, that's a whole different sort of kettle of fish, but it's a vast topic. And I think that the spiritual friendship movement in general tries to make too obvious and too simple something that is complicated and essential at the same time.
So I want to ask you specifically a little bit more about the term spiritual friendship, because as you said a few moments ago, there's a lot of meaning that you can pour into the word friend, and a lot of meaning, you know, spiritual is a huge term. I mean, what does that mean? So are there specific, you know, deeper issues that arise out of using the term spiritual friendship to kind of categorize something that would fall into that, some kind of relationship?
Well, I think in our modern era, there are a lot of issues that have to be kind of teased apart that are being conflated. And if you're going to be inside the church, I think you would definitely want to really nail down what you meant by spiritual. Do you mean the spark of human attraction that two people feel for each other's almost chemistry, you could say? I've definitely had this where some of my close friends right now are people I walked into a room and I started a conversation and I just sort of knew that we were going to be, as they say, kindred spirits. And we have been. We just sort of get each other. Is that what you mean by spiritual? Or do you mean something related to the gospel where we are talking about the spiritual realm where Christ dwells? Because if you're going to use spiritual in that second sense, then agape becomes your most pressing concern. You can become spiritual friends with anyone and everyone, and indeed you should be spiritually friends with your brothers and sisters in Christ. You can give yourself over for their good, whether or not you understand them or want to be with them or not. It becomes not so much about feeling, but about the mystical bond of Christ. Feelings come and go, but your relationship to them in terms of the gospel remains forever. So that's one of the biggest issues that I have. I feel like the term is used loosely both ways, and I think it should be more carefully defined. And then when you bring in underneath that the question of friendship, that's also very dicey, because people can share love for each other in many different capacities. I'm becoming friends, for instance, with my children now that they're teenagers. I've never been friends with them before, but they'll always be my children. I am friends with my husband, but of course that is not the same way that I'm friends with, you know, the women in my life who are my age. I'm friends with my parents in a way that I wasn't when I was young, but there's varying degrees of that. And when you add in the question of sexual orientation and attraction, then of course the issues get to be very thorny. And I think the spiritual friendship movement would like to keep the reader's eye on friendship without having to talk about sexual desire. And that's something the scriptures are so clear about. There's really no room for nuance about sexual desire, whereas of course, you can have layers and layers of meaning about the word love or friendship. So I think the danger ground for Christians as they talk about this is quite big, and it's getting bigger because it's so alluring. It's such a desirable thing to have community and belonging and friendship, but the question of sex complicates it so much.
Well, speaking of desire and specifically sexual desire, can Christians and should they enter into special types of friendships? And it seems to me, and you know, I'd like to ask you about that, that within the community that is wrestling with same-sex attraction and this idea of spiritual friendship, can you enter into almost not a marriage, of course, because they would say marriage is reserved between man and a woman, as the Bible teaches, but could you have some kind of special friendship, a kind of covenanted friendship with someone else that they might be attracted to, but they would never have a sexual relationship with? Or maybe one person would identify as someone who struggles with same-sex attraction, but maybe their special friendship is with another person of the same gender, but who would not describe themselves that way. They would describe themselves as heterosexual. Can Christians enter into these kind of special, like maybe exclusive friendships?
That's the essential question. And I think the spiritual friendship movement is saying a big yes. Yes, of course you can enter into covenanted friendships where maybe you even take vows to love each other, and you arrange your lives around each other, and you are attracted to each other, but you just won't engage in sexual activity. And I would say that that is so dangerous, and that actually Christians ought not to do that. You should not enter into a covenanted relationship with someone with whom you're sexually attracted, but for whatever reason, you're not to engage in sexual activity with. So a man who is attracted to a woman who's not his wife shouldn't enter into vows of friendship with her. He just shouldn't do that. And two men who are sexually attracted to each other should not enter into vows of friendship with each other, because they esteem their own ability for self-control too highly and probably their own virtue too lowly. They should have a higher view of God's holiness and a lower view of their own abilities. I think that's what the church fathers, the scriptures say, have said for centuries. And it's so naive to think that you would be able to do that and you would be chaste. Even if you did not engage in sexual activity, the fact that you're attracted to that person will eventually lead you at least to lust in one way or another, unless you are not willing to tell the truth to yourself or to other people, which is another danger. And Jesus is very stern about lust and what that constitutes. So I just think it's a really bad idea. And the fact that there's a whole movement in Christianity that's trying to say that it is a good idea is alarming to me. And I feel like if St. Paul were here, he would say, you've already failed. The fact that you're asking the question means that you, as a culture, as a Christian culture, have already failed and you should go back to the drawing board.
But what about the people who could be in a covenanted relationship when one person is not same-sex attracted? They don't have any sexual attraction to that other person. Could they keep the other person who might have that spark, could they keep them accountable? Because they don't have any sexual attraction because they would describe themselves as straight.
I mean, I, as a person who's been, you know, doing some pastoral care and meeting with people in their lives, doing a lot of marriage preparation, and when people fall into trouble with their friendships and their marriages, I would say the answer to that is probably not. You're probably not that strong. You can't make somebody else be good by the power of your will. And I feel dubious about pleas of Christian discipleship on behalf of people that, you know, well, I might be able, you know, in the world that calls themselves sort of gay Christian would say, well, you can you turn somebody else towards your sexual orientation? I think more and more people are saying, of course you can. You can attract somebody else to you, even if they've never said that they would ever be interested in that. We're seeing more and more cases of that. So it seems to me extremely naive to suggest that a person who isn't attracted to someone could enter into a covenanted relationship with someone who is attracted to them and then keep them on the straight and narrow. I'm sure it does happen, but it's a little bit like deciding to disobey the commandment not to marry somebody who's not a Christian. You shouldn't join yourself in spirit to someone, body and spirit, to someone who's not oriented and belonging to Christ, because you will very likely be pulled off course rather than you pulling them on course. It's that same kind of thing. It might turn out okay sometimes, but overall, I think it's a really bad idea.
So the modern church, you know, when talking about infidelity in marriage and people, you know, who are facing that, sometimes infidelity in a marriage is recognized as an emotional affair. For example, if pastors, I mean, we've seen this in the news lately, if pastors have been engaging in what's called, you know, in some kind of relationship with somebody other than their spouse, their wife, and even if nothing sexual has happened, they are deemed not to be fit to be in the pastoral ministry. And so those things are put under the category of emotional affairs. So I guess my question is, can spiritual friendships steer clear of something, a deep emotional connection that could be categorized, like, you know, in other ways as an emotional affair? Could it avoid becoming an emotional affair?
I mean, I guess, you know, in the way that a lot of things are possible, but many, many things are not advisable at all. And it is interesting to me, you know, we're very anxious about the friendships between men and women in the church, and how there's been an ongoing conversation about that and the dangers of falling into sexual sin. Just, it starts with a friendship and then it goes too far. We keep seeing it over and over again. And why would it be that in the world where you're talking about same-sex attraction, that wouldn't be the case? I think that's, of course, if you have a deep emotional connection to someone, the step from being sort of the mind, of the spirit, of the emotions, to being of the body is a very narrow step. And that's because we're designed to be united to another person, body and soul together. Those aren't supposed to be separated from each other. And so Yeah, I think it's, again, it's so naive. It's such a terrible idea. I think it would be very hard for a spiritual friendship where the two people were sexually attracted to each other to avoid an emotional affair. I don't know how you would do that. In fact, I think in some ways that's almost the point of having that kind of friendship, is to be united together on every level. And so it would definitely turn into an affair, I think.
Well, now I want to ask you specifically about scripture. Does, you know, scripture address this kind of relationship, like spiritual friendships, or what does scripture have to say in that realm about, you know, gender-specific friendships? And when we look at the Old Testament, it seems to me that many times the relationship that's cited is Jonathan and David, that they were closer even than brothers. So did Jonathan and David have this kind of spiritual friendship?
The movement, the modern movement, claims that they did. And in fact, if you go over into the side A world, that they claim, many, many people claim that Jonathan and David were sexually involved with each other. They were in love. And that's the place they go to find justification for same-sex sexual activity in the Bible. Both Wes Hill and Nate Collins appeal to David and Jonathan having this sort of deep, deep spiritual, emotional connection that rivaled that of David with all of his wives, of course, which, you know, that's a very interesting subject. I don't know why you would necessarily look to David for a well-ordered view of how men and women should relate, because he did have many wives. So he already falls short of the biblical standard, I would say, of the friendship that should exist between a man and his wife, and the romance and the eroticism. Those things should be tightly wound together. So yes, the Bible holds up David and Jonathan and their friendship as a really beautiful thing, but it's contrasted in many different ways with other kinds of relationships in the Bible. And I have not found good exegesis to say that they had the modern iteration of spiritual friendship. I don't think that they did. I haven't found any scholars who've convinced me that that's what they have. And so, yes, of course, they made covenant with each other. Many people look at those words and say that it was really like almost like a vassal, that Jonathan was pledging himself to David, who he knew was going to be king. And also, again, when you try to take what we're talking about right now and impose it back over the scriptures, the very ancient scriptures, that's not something we can do. We really should look at what was going on, the paradigms and the teaching about love in the Bible, and bring it forward to our day, rather than looking back at individual relationships, which may or may not have been good or bad, and taking those as formative or normative for what the Bible wants us to do. So I don't see evidence that David and Jonathan had what we would term right now a spiritual friendship. I don't see that in the text.
A few minutes ago, you used the term side A, and for people who are new to the podcast, they might not know what that term means. So can you please tell us, what do you mean by when you say the term side A?
There's a debate within, I use the word Christian sort of advisedly, maybe in scare quotes, within Christian circles about whether or not it's okay for people who are same-sex attracted to engage in sexual activity. And side B Christians, of which Wes Hill, Nate Collins, Eve Tushnet have all called themselves side B, would say that the Bible teaches that you ought not to engage in same-sex sexual activity. The Bible prohibits that. They are on side B, and that's what they call the traditional sexual ethic. But on the other side of that, side A, are those, quote, Christians who say that the Bible and God do allow for same-sex attracted Christians to engage in sexual activity. They would support civil unions and gay marriage, and say that the Bible blesses those sexual unions, and they are called side A. I think, just for my own purposes, I always would put the word Christian in scare quotes with side A, because I think that the Bible absolutely prohibits same-sex sexual activity under any circumstances. And so you can't be a Christian who says that that's okay. Those two things defeat themselves. So, but it's an ongoing debate within sort of Christian circles, as it were.
Well, now I want to ask you a little bit about the New Testament, because I think just in this discussion, people are going to wonder, who are Christians, aren't we called to be friends with brothers and sisters in Christ? And specifically, I want to ask you about what's typically referred to in evangelical circles as, you know, people, you know, gender-specific friendships that are mentoring relationships, the ones that the Apostle Paul talks about in Titus chapter 2, where he specifically says that, you know, older men and younger men and older women and younger women are to be in relationships with each other for the sake of the gospel. So are these spiritual friendships that are being talked about, do they fall under what Paul is talking about in terms of discipleship in doctrine, as well as, you know, practical application of doctrine in a Christian's life?
I would say this is a much better use of the word spiritual friendship, because you can be friends and you can be helped along by someone in the spirit, in your faith. And I would say the first thing about that, of course, is that you would not be sexually attracted to that person. Paul is saying, you know, the older women should teach the younger women. They're not sexually attracted to the younger women. They're probably all mothers and they need help learning how to deal with life and how to apply the scriptures and how to be good and faithful Christians and obedient to the Lord. And likewise with older men and younger men. And so there is in those texts, so you can see, is sort of a power differential. An older woman who comes alongside, is this a very Christianese kind of thing to say, but comes alongside a younger woman to instruct her even and help her in her life and befriend her. It's of an elder to a younger person, of a mature believer to a less mature believer. And so there's things that can be learned, but there's, of course, a deep sharing of life. There's prayer together. It's the core of Christian community being formed and founded together. And it really shouldn't be confused with, I do think that evangelicals have created an idea of mentorship and even discipleship that is not exactly what I think the scriptures talk about. And that's where you could sort of, quote, mentor anyone really and help them in their life. And you can take your ideas about God and help them. It can be a one-on-one thing. Whereas what I think Paul's describing is very much the community together, first of all. We shouldn't imagine atomized American life as the context that Paul is describing. So it's a community together where people live in close proximity to each other. They help each other with material needs and considerations. They probably pray together liturgically and more than once a week. And so in their, quote, doing of life together, they're uniquely bonded by circumstance, perhaps, you know, poverty, wealth, maybe they're helping each other. And yet they're instructing each other and helping in that. That's the basis of the friendship. And then feelings, deep feelings of affection will grow out of that, of course. But sexuality should not be imposed or mapped onto that thing that Paul is describing. I think that really confuses the issues. And I really do think the reason that we have this question of, quote, spiritual friendship coming up is because in the West, we've abandoned what the New Testament would probably describe a church to look like, a community of Christians to look like. We think that we can move wherever we want with no consequences. We think that we can choose our friends rather than having God give them to us when we enter into a church. We think that we can commodify certain sort of emotional needs and get them in a lot of different places rather than focusing our whole energy in the church, the worship of the church, the teaching of the church, and the service of the church.
So I think some of this stems out of, and I don't know, I don't know all the motivations for some of the folks in the movement, but I think it's not just the movement of those who would identify themselves as gay Christians, but also just certain Christians who feel like being part of a church congregation is not enough to meet their relational needs in terms of specifically because in the evangelical church, I mean, there has been a literal focus on the family so that if you are not in a family unit, like you're a single person or you're widowed or you're divorced or something like that, you're just not the quote unquote norm in a Christian congregation. And so you kind of feel like you're on the margins and the outside. So, you know, this is attractive because it seems like a lot of churches really kind of marginalize those people. There's not a way for people who are struggling, who don't have, you know, like an immediate, you know, family, husband, wife, kids, or that kind of a thing, to be around them to give them that emotional support that they do long for.
I do think it is a big indictment on the church in America and the West that we are having a movement like this grow up. And it is both a symptom of a deep sort of shallowness that we've embraced culturally, that you're right, we've privileged the family over the church. And so we don't really have churches that meet the spiritual needs of the people who walk in the door. And we should have always privileged the church over the family, because in the same way that if you look for happiness, you will be very unhappy. If you try to have any of the goods of the Christian life without devoting yourself to Christ, you end up not having any of those goods either. So if you look, our families are in disarray. It's interesting that many people in the spiritual friendship movement feel like their marriages are not sufficient either. They're not finding the goods of friendship in marriage. They want to go somewhere else for it. They're not finding the goods of friendship in the church. They have to go look in other places for that. And I think, you know, in a couple of years, we'll find that the spiritual friendship movement was not able to meet the needs of those who were looking for spiritual friendship. And that's because we are still, for some reason, trying to find the goods associated with the Christian life without actually having to be devoted to Christ. Only Jesus can be the friend that we need, and only he can form a community of believers really through worship, when people commit to going to one congregation over the course of a lifetime, sacrificing everything for the sake of the church, and discovering as they do that, that they end up with family, with love, with community, even with traditions and institutions that can carry them on. We're seeing a great unraveling because we didn't focus on Jesus, really. We focused on the family. And now we're focusing on friendship, but that's no better a solution than focusing on the family was.
Well, I want to go back and ask you a little bit more, because you just barely mentioned this monk from the 12th century who wrote a book on spiritual friendship. And so I want to ask you, just, you know, in one sense, this sounds like something modern, like the Platonic marriage movement. But in another sense, here's somebody from church history from so long ago who wrote about what he said the Bible taught about spiritual friendship. So I just want to ask you about church history. Has the church, in church history, the church itself or church fathers, has anyone said anything about this, specifically because this monk is writing about it? It doesn't seem like that this is a new concept, this kind of like arrangement, almost on the, you know, like you said, marriage adjacent with no sexual interaction.
It has come up in the church from very early on. So Aelred was in the 1100s, and by that time, the monastic movement was really entrenched. There were monastic opportunities for both men and women. And that was, of course, a very high good. But the idea of sort of the Western ideals about romance were becoming more fully fixed at that point and entering the common mind more fully, I think. But if you reach past Aelred, who, again, I want to reiterate, we should not think that Aelred had in mind in his book on spiritual friendship modern same-sex sexual attraction. I think he was talking about really that spiritual spark that will the convivial, the kindred spark that two people feel for each other, but that's undergirded by Christ when they are worshiping together in a monastic community, that you could have a deep friendship with, you know, two brothers in a monastery. You'd have a deep friendship that wasn't sexual in nature at all and was oriented around the prayers and the service of worshiping Christ. So you should be really careful when you're reading him not to impose your own ideas of today back. But reaching past Aelred, I mean, already by that point, he is shifting that word to mean this sort of intimate kindred spirit bond. It's a little bit fuzzy by the time you get to Aelred. If you go back to the early church fathers, Jerome, the Council of Nicaea mentions the term spiritual friendship, and they, in their canon number 3, of the First Council of Nicaea, they say, this great synod absolutely forbids a bishop, presbyter, deacon, or any of the clergy to keep a woman who has been brought in to live with him, with the exception, of course, of his mother or sister or aunt or any person who is above suspicion. So what was happening is that monks at the time, because there were not really the opportunity for women to enter into monastic life, monks were getting young women usually, and having them come and keep house for them. And of course, it was very chaste, no sexual activity, but this was called a spiritual friendship. She would do his laundry and he would, you know, have someone to talk to in the evenings. And then I guess they would sleep in separate beds. Or maybe she would be very rich and he would manage her estates. And that way he wouldn't have to be a poor monk. And so the church is forbidding this because it, at the very least, it looks bad to the world. It looks very suspicious. And so the monk should really only have his mother or sister or aunt. And then St. Chrysostom really takes on the issue and writes, he's not called golden-tongued for nothing, but I loved somebody talking about what he wrote here. This is such a great line. There's two lines that I'd like to read because he puts his finger on the issue. First, he says that it's not a spiritual love, he says, that drew couples together in his day, but concupiscence in disguise, which modern spiritual friendship tries to fuzz over the question of concupiscence and say that it's not sin. But the church has always said that your desire to sin is itself sin. You can't just say that the action of sin is the only thing that's wrong. But then here's what Elizabeth Clark describing Chrysostom's view. For Chrysostom, living together without indulging in sexual intercourse could only serve to fan the flames of lust. The married man, to whom sexual opportunity was ever present, often became satiated and lost the passion he earlier had felt for his bride. As for the woman, the cares of the household and the bodily strain of childbearing and child-rearing took a heavy toll on her physical beauty, and her diminished attractiveness no doubt served to dampen further her husband's already wilting ardor. Chrysostom didn't write very nicely about women, so that's one thing that you have to hear in this, but she goes on. But with these monks, desire was intensified with the passage of time because it was never satiated. The constant association of the two, eating, drinking, talking, and laughing together, promoted a state of perpetual sexual arousal. Chrysostom compared a monk who consented to live in this fashion to someone who had a table of delicacies set before him, but was instructed not to eat, or to one ravaged by thirst, who was led to a stream, but not permitted to drink. And I think you couldn't say it more clearly in all the reading that I did, especially Nate Collins' book, All But Invisible. I felt like he was describing that really lust that two people have for each other, and then saying, but it's okay, we just don't have to do that, we won't do that, and it'll be fine. And it's like lighting something, you know, lighting a match in a hayfield and saying, there's not going to be a problem here. It's very short-sighted.
So finally, like, you know, what should churches do? I mean, this is a huge topic. I don't think we can cover all the nuances of it, because we did recognize that there are people, not just those who would identify as same-sex attracted or gay Christians, but, you know, people who are single parents or widows or things that they feel like they're not having opportunities to make friendships, and everybody wants to have friendships. So how should churches minister to those people who struggle in this way? Like I said, it could be someone with same-sex attraction who feels misunderstood by the church and kind of on the outside, or just others who are longing for deep, meaningful relationships. I mean, especially those who used to have them, like if you were widowed or divorced and know firsthand what you're missing, especially for those who are widowed or even those who are divorced. Maybe they, when they were first married, they had that deep, meaningful relationship and they just don't find any opportunities in the church.
I think, I mean, we as the Western church have a lot of repairing to do. I do think we're in both chaos and ruin. A lot of churches, especially in COVID, I think the cracks that were already there became very obvious, and the deep loneliness that Christians feel, that it ought not to have been that way. We got to finally taste and see how things really are inside of churches. I think the first thing that the church should do is, you know, begin to repent and say sorry to God for not having built the church. I think the second thing to do is to really bolster and build up worship. Worship should be deep and rich. There should be a lot of good singing and really solid exegesis, and there should be a communion very often, the Lord's table. And worship should be centered and privileged, given enough time. You shouldn't worry that it's, you know, if it's only an hour. And then, you know, just repairing things, starting to try to have dinners after church every week, you know, maybe at least a monthly potluck as a congregation, and then build to every other week, and start to have to call families to orient their lives around the church rather than trying to cater to and orient themselves around families. I think that's the only way to begin to pull people back into the margins, because in this sort of fractured world, when the church is trying to serve its families rather than call the whole body to worship and adore Christ and be built up in the Spirit and hear the word and partake of the table together, we're all orienting ourselves towards Christ. The church still has this posture of sort of serving or dishing up dinner, you know, spiritual meals to people who are consumers. And we can't fix it until we reorient ourselves around Christ and, you know, repent for not doing it that way in the first place, recatechizing people and building community so that families are called to the church building in person to commune with together in a variety of different ways, build ministry out of that. Then people who are on the edge will be able to come in to a warm, rich space and not feel like they're on the outs because they don't have a spouse or they don't have kids. I think that's really hard to do, especially, but you can use technology to do it. In our church, we use a lot of technology during the week, a lot of Zoom, to build towards our Sunday worship. But then our Sunday worship has primacy. Everything else gives way before that. And our community is beginning to rebuild after that, as a result of that primary worship. And I think a lot of churches are doing this around the country, but It's a toilsome labor. Nobody will notice that you're doing it, except those few people who really are on the edge and who are deeply lonely and who need the love of Christ and the love of the community to get their lives put back together.
I do have a question for you based on what you just said. You used the word that churches need to catechize people. I think most evangelicals in America, I know you're from the Anglican tradition, but that is a liturgical tradition. But I would say most evangelicals in America don't come from any kind of liturgical tradition. So what do you mean by with that word?
Well, in our church, catechize, we have really robust education, you know, Sunday school and teaching on Sunday and then during the week. So we have a sort of Sunday school program for every single person in our church, including the babies, and all the way through adult. And that includes Bible and church history, but a lot of teaching about the liturgy itself. What are we doing? Why are we here? Why are we doing the things that we're doing on Sunday? But then the idea of catechizing the congregation goes further than that, because it does take on this in-person relationships that people have with each other, where they bring each other along towards Christ and they fill in the details of what Christian living looks like, how to grow up, how to think about the gospel and the Bible, the paradigm, the sort of intellectual and emotional furniture that you need in order to be a Christian. One thing I would say is part of our general catechesis that's not on purpose, we didn't mean it this way, is that as we've taught our people to read the Bible, they've begun to read other books too. So now people are reading lots of different kinds of literature and talking about it with each other and beginning to form a Christian view of the cosmos, which I would say is even bigger than sort of saying having a Christian worldview, which I think is part of what catechesis is about.
But what would you say to the Christian who says, you know, maybe I just need to find a different church because, frankly, I feel really different than the people in my church. They're not like me at all. And I just don't envision any of them as friends because they don't have the same interests as me. And it doesn't seem like there's much there. So how do I find that body where I'm going to really connect? Because part of spiritual friendship, as I understand what you've said, is kind of like having this, you know, connection. I mean, in their context, meaning like a soulmate, but even other than that, Christians that we want to do life with, we have something beyond, of course, we're all together in Christ, but you know, there's some other ways in which we feel like, okay, these people kind of get me, you know, that I'm in a small group with or whatever. But sometimes people feel on the outs because they look around at their congregation and they're just like, who are these people? And I don't think I like very many of them. And I don't think they're like me.
That's a really essential question. And it's a hard one because I think there's two answers to it. One, I think you're going to probably walk into some churches and then just walk right back out again because you just, the ethos of it or however it goes, you're going to get that you don't get it or you just don't want it. And that's just part of being in the modern world. It's not really good, but I don't think there's anything to do about it. You know, if you're in a church and you just feel completely on the outs and you think, well, I'm never going to get it. And we've definitely had people come visit us and sort of you can look at them and think, well, they don't know who we are or why we're here. And then they don't visit again. So that's not really a good biblical answer. I would say the better answer, the more true answer is that God gives us our friends when we come into his church. And as long as a congregation is preaching the word rightly, administering the sacraments, and exercising church discipline, then it is a godly and good church. And so you can go there knowing that things are going to be okay. And when you submit yourself to that body and enter in to the life of that congregation, you are joined mystically and spiritually as a friend to all those other people, as a brother and sister in Christ. That supersedes any of your feelings or your ability to perceive it with your senses. It's a reality that is true. And gradually, as you go on, you discover that your inclinations, your desires, your feelings bend towards that church. God appoints your friends for you. You don't really, your spiritual friends, you don't really get to pick them. He makes you into a living body, and he joins you to other people, whether you like them or not. He gives you the affections that you need. He will satisfy your needs and longings, sometimes by using other people, but surely by giving you himself in the scriptures and the sacraments. And then you can give yourself to other people. So it's this difficult but strange, it's quite beautiful process that's slow. It doesn't happen overnight. It maybe happens in fits and starts. But I've noticed that when people join themselves to us in our local church here and then decide that they just want to go away, but they've really entered into the communion and become friends with people, when they go away, they can't replicate that. They end up with an immense sense of loss, and it takes them years to rebuild, longer than if they had never had it. And so that's really interesting thing. And it's something that modern people don't know they need that, but every person from the beginning of time has needed that. That's what we were created for. And so we should just give in and accept that that's how it is.
I really like that idea of God picking our friends for us in the context. They might not be somebody we have picked, but sometimes God gives us friends in such unusual ways, people we wouldn't have picked ourselves. So that's very interesting. So thank you for your insights. And people who are new listeners to this podcast may not know that Anne is also a pastor's wife. Her husband is a pastor in New York. Well, finally, I have a fun rapid fire question for Anne that I'm going to call marriage adjacent. So where did you meet your husband and where did you get married?
We actually met in the first day of seminary studies, and we fell in love, and it was very well. No, actually, I think we felt like God arranged our marriage for us before we even really knew each other or liked each other. So it was very awkward in the beginning. But we got married in Oregon, and then we're in Virginia for a bit, and now we're up in New York.
Well, thanks, Anne, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. This was fun.
You've been listening to episode 313 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Anne Kennedy. She has written an in-depth, online-exclusive feature article for the Christian Research Journal. Her article is called Spiritual Friendship, Temptation, or Belonging? Our subscribers can read her article for free at our website, equip.org, since subscriptions come with the free online access to exclusive articles. If you would like to read her article, please go to our website, equip.org, and subscribe for $33.50. Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And in that podcast, he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that. And every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.